Eric Palmer joined the Marine Corps in August of 2002 because he wanted to continue the tradition of his family and their service in the military. When the September 11th terrorist attacks happened in 2001, the deal was sealed and he signed up. After 13 weeks of boot camp, he spent 45 days in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, training to become a heavy equipment operator and fulfilled various roles in that job description during his 4 years of duty to include squad leader. He achieved the rank of E4 or corporal before being honorably discharged in 2006. He served in Iraq during Operation Enduring Freedom 1, 2, 3, and 4, and volunteered to stay with different units when he didn't have to. Eric loved the camaraderie of brotherhood the Marines provided. Eric now owns Southwest Exterminators and is a successful business owner. He is the ultimate pest assassin as his company kills countless bugs of all sorts every day. He lives with his beautiful wife and kids where they enjoy the bounties of living in America. Hello everyone and welcome to Ghost Turd Stories. I'm your host, Troy Gent. Ghost Turd Stories' mission is using humorous and challenging stories from veterans and first responders to reduce the burden of families whose veteran or first responder took their own life. Ghost Turd Stories' vision is to use humorous and challenging stories to prevent suicide within our ranks and reduce the burden of families whose veteran or first responder took their own life. We hope to attract veterans and first responders, as well as those interested in knowing more about what it's like to be in our shoes while we wear or wore those shoes. At Ghost Turd Stories, we tell and write the stories of veterans and first responders for their families and friends. We love storytelling and believe there is nothing more inspiring and nothing that gets people to take action like a great story. Families and friends want to know the sacrifices we made, the services we rendered, and the people we lifted, so they can be inspired and learn about the legacy we left. Our podcast is the face of our company, but we want every family who cares to know about the experiences their veteran and/or first responder went through for them. We interview veterans and first responders, collect pictures, write their stories, and compile them in a book for their families and friends to enjoy. Oftentimes, it's difficult for us to talk to our loved ones about what we did, saw, and heard while serving. At Ghost Turd Stories, we bridge the gap. For pricing, visit linktr.ee/ghostturdstories and click on the second tab directly under the podcast link called Let Us Write Your Story. That's linktr.ee/ghostturdstories. Eric, thank you so much for joining me for this podcast. Tell me a little bit about how you joined the Marine Corps, why you joined the Marine Corps, and when.
Well, first, thank you for the opportunity. Pleasure to be here. Come from a military family, multiple generations. You know, here in Utah, for the listeners who are not in the state of Utah, there is this polite expectation that young, worthy men are going to go serve a mission, but it isn't an overt pressure. In my family, there was an expectation that you're going to serve in the military, but it wasn't an overt pressure. So it was always percolating in the back of my brain that I was going to join, but I hadn't gotten any of the balls, you know, rolling on that.
Yeah.
September 11th happens, and man, that got a whole lot of people's balls rolling to get into the recruiting office. And at the time, I was still in high school, was working at a McDonald's, and the recruiting office for all four branches was in that same shopping center. And it was 2 days after 9/11, because I was working that day. And I try to go into the recruiting office, and the line is out the door.
Really?
And I'm like, there's no way I'm going to wait in this line. I don't like lines, you know, for any reason.
And this was where?
This was Salinas, California.
Salinas, California. Okay.
So I leave. I come back. It was a few days later. And when you walked into the main hall, the Navy was on the immediate left, the first left. The Marine Corps was on the immediate first right. The Army was on further down the hallway on the left. And then the Air Force was furthest down the hallway. And my grandfather retired Army. My dad, Army. I was going to go Army. That was what it was going to be. And so I start walking down the hallway. And as I pull into the recruiting, you know, their particular office, there's a fair number of guys in there, you know, somewhere around a dozen. It wasn't, you know, as crazy as it was a few days ago, but I didn't want to wait. So I turned around again. I'll just come back another day. And I'm walking out the communal hallway, and this yoked gunny, absolutely yoked gunny, grabs me by the shoulder, pulls me right in and says, "Ah, if the Army don't want to talk to you, boy, I'll be more than happy to talk to you." And 30 minutes later, I had a delayed entry contract signed for the Marine Corps. Had no intention of joining the Marine Corps when I walked into that office, but I'm very, very glad that I did.
Yeah, snatched you right up.
Yep, yep. Well, he had to make his quota too, and I guess I made it too easy on him.
Sure. You say you're really glad that you did. Looking back, why? I mean, the Marine Corps, I mean, I agree, I'm a Marine too, but why did that register like, "Oh, I'm so glad I joined the Marine Corps instead of the Army"?
It really does come down to the esprit de corps of Marines, the deep brotherhood. Now, in any trauma-bonded industry, whether you're paramedics, police, firefighting, Army, Navy, there's a level of camaraderie that is uniform between all of these trauma-bonded professions.
Yeah.
But I think the Marine Corps does take it to a higher degree. When I talk to buddies who were soldiers, they go, "Yeah, well, I liked my unit, but, you know, it was a job. And, man, it was free college. It was wonderful." And that seemed to be what their focus was. What was the benefit?
I have rarely talked to a Marine. I don't think I've ever talked to a Marine that said, "I joined for the money."
Yeah.
Because if you wanted the money, it's a lot better other places. So.
Yeah. Well, and I tell guys, this is not the best story. If you're thinking about joining the Marine Corps, this is not the best story to listen to. But I have guys who've come up to me after I've done my combat tours and said, "Hey, I'm looking to get in the military. Should I join the Marine Corps?" And my questions are always the same. First, are you married? If you're married, do not join the Marine Corps. It is just not conducive. It's going to end in divorce. I'm just telling you. I said, but breaking it down, if you are looking for the least military-esque military that you will have a high probability of job skills that will transition you into the civilian world, go Air Force. I mean, you're still military, you get all your benefits, but it's the least militarized, and it's why the other services make fun of the Air Force. Yeah. Oh, it's a chair force. if you want all of those technical skills that you would get in the Air Force, but you want to travel, go Navy. But do not go Navy if you are married. You, even in peacetime, you're constantly on deployment. Peacetime, wartime, you're gone. So if you're married, don't go Navy. If you're 18 years old, you're single, you're a male, you've got some testosterone, you got a chip on your shoulder, you got something to prove, you want an opportunity to travel, but you don't want to have the absolute snot kicked out of you, go Army. Great for you. And if you're 18 years old, way too much testosterone, major chip on your shoulder, and you just want to get smacked around and smack other people around, that's when you go
Marine
Corps.
That's why I joined the Marine Corps. Now, I just realized it.
So I tell guys, if that describes you, then the Marine Corps is going to be great for you. But I never want anyone to say that they've chatted with me and that I've led them astray. I want you to know exactly what you're going to get. I'm not a recruiter. I'm not looking for to make quota. If you got too much testosterone and you got something to prove, man, the Marine Corps is a wonderful, wonderful place. And it's, you know, I haven't done everything this life has to offer, but dagnabbit, the relationships that I made with those boys during deployment, I can honestly say that I love the men that I was deployed with.
Whether it was, I agree.
House, Hilsgen, Silva, Pilkington, Trejo, Bishop, Simpson, Russell the Love Muscle. These are guys I still have conversations with, and, you know, just a phone call away. And in no other area of my life have I built that level of relationship with another guy.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I know I asked you to think of two to three of the funniest experiences that you had in the Marine Corps, while in the Marine Corps, and if you've got more, feel free to share. And then also two to three of your most difficult experiences. And then if you have history with post-traumatic stress or mental health challenges, how you managed those and overcame those. So I'll go ahead and let you run with it. I know you're prepared, so.
Well, I'll say one of the stories, and actually I have to side note here, and thank you yet again. When we spoke offline a few weeks prior to this recording, you asked me, hey, just percolate on what you'd want to talk about, what you're willing to share, etc. I sat down with my wife, we were having a conversation, and I realized just how much I had forgotten. Bits and pieces of stories and you know, things that, I kind of remember that, you know, we were stationed near Fallujah, but what in the heck were we doing? So this, just preparing for this interview, gave me an opportunity to reach out to several of my boys that I haven't talked to, for some of them, in several years, trying to clarify, because I didn't want to come on your show and start with a story and then have my boys call me out. That's not how that happened. What are you talking about? I wanted to make sure I had my facts as straight as I could get them. So again, thank you for the opportunity. But yeah, one of the stories that most of my boys all looked back fondly was OAF2. So I was there for OAF1, the breaking of the berm. The war, that really wasn't a war, it was a police action, but the war portion. After President Bush went on the USS Reagan and had mission accomplished, that was when we started OAF2. And at the end of OAF2, I, like many other Marines, got that dreaded Dear John letter from my fiance. And so I was totally woman-hating, didn't want to come home, decided to stay out. I don't want to come home, screw that. Blah, blah, blah. So I stayed out on OAF3. I moved from 1st MARDIV to 2nd MARDIV and just stayed in Fallujah. And then I was there for a portion of OAF4.
So in a four-year enlistment, how long were you in Iraq?
In theater, a total of 36 months.
Jeez.
I look at that now and say that was a blessing, because I talk to Marines and especially soldiers, but I talk to enlisted who spent more time in CONUS, Continental United States, and the amount of, I can't use the word I was going to use, the silly games that get played in the motor pool when you've got nothing to do, and the, you know, senior staff.
You can swear on here if you want.
Okay, the fuck games.
Okay.
Okay. I was trying. I didn't know where the line was. No, so.
Just tell a story. I'm not worried about it.
I hear about what they dealt with, and that was not my reality. That was not my 4 years. Again, it was the quote war. And
yeah, that seems rare. I know people have been on, like, you know, lots of deployments, but more time in country like that, 36 months in 4 years. That's pretty incredible.
So. Yeah. And again, I think a lot of that was because I volunteered to stay. I didn't want to, whether it was OAF1, my unit went back and I kept volunteering.
So
to
that stay. Was 36 months concurrently? Like you just.
No. Okay. That was between all four deployments. Okay. So 36 months cumulative.
But you weren't back but a couple months each time at least.
Correct. Yeah. I think there was one time I think I was only back for a little over 2 months. It wasn't even a full 3 months.
Okay.
But so one of the stories to, you know, so I'm not belaboring or getting too far off topic. We built our own hot tub while we were out there, and I can't take credit for this. I helped on the project, but Corporal Hilsgen, Joshua Hilsgen, he was the guy that kind of led this. We were stationed at this time. This was Alta Kadam Air Force Base, so Saddam's Air Force Base that we had taken over, and we had converted that into our tarmac. So Air Force was coming in, and as a heavy equipment operator, while we were at this particular portion of the mission, it was logistical support. We had the tarmac that we were manning, and we had what's called the SMU, the Supply Management Unit. And at this time, I was informed, I don't know if this is true or not, but I was informed that the Fallujah SMU was the second largest supply management unit in the entire Marine Corps. We had over 1 million individual serial numbers that were in this SMU.
Okay.
And heavy equipment, we knew where everything was because we were the ones that put it there.
Yeah.
And so there was also this dump nearby. So we had access to supply. We had access to the dump. And for the most part, especially while we were in country, most people just left the heavy equipment operators alone. So Hilsgen gets this great idea that he wants to build a hot tub.
Who is it the top of the food chain within this little unit of yours that knows that you're doing this?
I don't know if anyone knew we were doing it when we were doing it. We tried to. So actually, this was the genius of our plan. For those of you who have been in the military, if you're familiar with Air Force pallets, these are large, flat pallets that fit into military transport vehicles. If you've ever watched the movie Dumbo Drop, which now I'm dating myself, but if you've ever watched the movie Dumbo Drop, that large metal plate that they put the elephant on when they're parachuting them down into, I think that's Vietnam.
Yeah.
That's an Air Force pallet. Well, an Air Force pallet fits perfectly into an ISO container, those shipping Connex containers you see at port. And so we intentionally built our hot tub on an Air Force pallet so that when brass did come down, we could hide it in an ISO container, lock it up, and no one could find it. So Hilsgen comes up with this great idea, and several of us in HE platoon start scavenging for parts. We were able to find two broken water heaters and enough parts to get them functioning. They weren't great, but they certainly, you know, made hotter water. We stole the hydraulic hoses from Motor T. Thank you, Motor T. Your sacrifice was well enjoyed. We got the timbers for building the decking around the hot tub. We got that from the supply management unit. I think we got that through legitimate means. I don't think we stole those. But I think it's been far enough away that I can fully admit now without worrying about military justice coming after me. The 5,000-gallon tank, I stole that from the Army, and I am not even sorry for it. I took, it's called an MMV, Military Millennium Vehicle, or Millennium Military Vehicle. It's a forklift. And I left our area of Fallujah, which the Marine Corps area, and went over to the Army area. And the Army had just, they have more stuff. They have a larger budget. They are more well supplied than the Marine Corps is. And so they had this motor pool that was just sand, but a motor pool that had all of the spare components. And all right, well, they've got enough over there anyway. I'm just going to go ahead and take one of those. I dip my forks right into the sand, get underneath this 5,000-gallon tank, pick it up, and I just start driving away.
This is in the middle of the day.
Just in the middle of the day. This is right around lunchtime.
Were you wearing Marine Corps stuff or just
No, it was full uniform. I did nothing to conceal myself. I wasn't trying to be stealthy in the least. It was, you know, when they say that the easiest time to steal is if you look like you know what you're doing. I looked like I know what I was doing. I was there. This is just part of my mission.
Did you do any recon before that?
No, I drove by. There it is. I'm going to take it. I just knew that Hilsgen
said. Were you even looking for it at the time?
Yes, because Hilsgen, we had, as a unit or as a platoon, we had talked about what we need and where we're going to find it. And I believe, and Hilsgen, if I'm getting this part of the story wrong, I apologize. But I believe we were looking for a water tank to use as the basin for the hot tub at the dump. That was the original plan, was to get one from the dump. Nobody was able to find one. And so there, it's sitting right there in the Army motor pool. We'll just grab that one. And so I'm driving away with this thing, and it's bouncing all over the place. And I'm thinking in my head, the smart thing to do is to ratchet strap this down. But now, you know, now you're getting the cold sweats.
You're sweating and stuff.
I gotta get out of the Army's area and get back into Marine Corps area. Then I can secure the load. And as I'm driving away, I think it was a first sergeant. I want to say it was an Army first sergeant. It just, you know, fully dedicated, you know, straight at me, you know, chest out, you know, coming right up to me. What are you doing? And I said, oh, well, I was sent here by Warrant Officer Penny. Who? Warrant Officer Penny sent me over to pick this up. He's, I don't know, Officer Warner. I said, just go talk to S1. They'll show you where Warrant Officer Penny is. I have no idea who.
Were you making this up on the fly?
Yep, right off the fly. Yep. But it worked because that's the unfortunate part of the miscommunication in the military is if you throw out a rank and a name, you know,
there's so many damn people over there. Who knows, right?
Exactly, like,
okay,
exactly.
I guess so.
If that first sergeant ever did go to S1 and look for Warrant Officer Pennywise or Penny, sorry, guy doesn't exist. Or at least I hope he doesn't. You watch, there was one Warrant Officer Penny out there.
Yeah.
But so I was able to grab this tank. I don't know where we scavenged up the tools from, if it was from Motor T or whatnot. But we were able to cut this tank down, turn it into a basin. We had the timber.
Is it a 6,000 gallon tank?
It was a I believe it was a 5,000 gallon.
Did you cut it in half? Or did
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, just cut it about hip level. So because it was just a basin, there was no seats inside. So when we finally got the entire thing put together on the Air Force pallet and had everything working, again, it was hot water. It wasn't bubbly. The hoses that we used didn't build up enough pressure to make it a real jacuzzi. But after several months in theater, being able to just, rather than having the 3 to 5 minute shower at the shower trailer that's just a little bit better than lukewarm, we had hot water and you had at least a little bit of a jet coming through these hydraulic hoses, and then we put just hydraulic nipples on the end. So that was our reducer to get to get some pressure going. But dagnabbit, it worked. And it was, if nothing else, it was a great morale improvement. Yeah. One, it was something to do when we were bored and didn't have a lot, you know, going on. And two, again, morale boost. And that can be the difference between a unit that is gelling in a high stress situation versus guys that are constantly at each other's throats.
Yeah.
When you're there and you've got a mission and you got to get it done, you gotta get it done. But during that downtime, if you can just play some stupid games with one another and build up a good camaraderie, a good relationship, it helps you guys as a unit deal with the high stress. Second story, just briefly, and this has to do with a little bit of a water story as well. I was a PFC. This is OAF 1. We're at FOB Solomon Islands. So this is right after breaking the berm. We're at the very southern end of Iraq. The war, quote unquote, had just kicked off. And, you know, I'm a stupid private. I there was no time with my unit. When I got out of MOS school, we went into what was called CRC, which the by-the-books term is combat replacement company, but everyone knows what it really means. It was casualty replacement company. that was what CRC was. And so they just sent you where extra bodies were needed. But I'm a stupid private. I have no idea what's going on. I'm over now in theater. I'm with two of my buddies that I was at MOS school, William Simpson, Billy, and Russell the Love Muscle.
Your unit's mission is right now is to push up Iraq?
Correct,
so you're doing, okay.
We're staged.
You're part of the push.
Correct, yes, okay. Yes. But we get word that a 3-star is helicoptering in. Like a day prior or a few days prior, I had just got promoted. I was big. I was bad. I was a PFC. Oh, yeah. Now I've got some clout. And so it was my first command over Billy and Russell the Love Muscle, who were still privates. And so our command, my grand command, was to burn trash to get the camp ready, the FOB ready.
You have to tell me later why you call him Russell the Love Muscle.
Yeah, all right. Maybe said there was some words I could use, but there's some stories that, yeah, should better.
Okay, now that you say that, I guess I can kind of guess what.
Units, we pass things around in a unit. And,
okay.
Well, anyway, we're told that we're going to burn, we have to burn all this garbage. Well, being a genius PFC in command of these two genius privates, we decide, hey, we're going to take 10 jerry cans of diesel and chuck them in. So we built berms that were about, I don't know, 15 feet tall or something. It was like a 20 by 20 foot burn area. Chuck these 10 jerry cans of diesel in there because diesel burns long. And it burns nice and hot, but it doesn't ignite very quickly. So again, genius. We're going to throw some aviation fuel in there. Mogas. We're going to throw 10 jerry cans of Mogas in there, along with the 10 jerry cans of diesel. And then, and so this is, again, genius moments that we're having. And just like the cartoons, I swear this was my moment of being Wile E. Coyote. I get in the center of this 20 by 20 foot burn area, and I have my one jerry can of Mogas. Now, I have fuel all over. We had jumpsuits at this time. It was a tricolor desert jumpsuits. So my jumpsuits are drenched in just different petroleum products, Mogas included. So I start making my drag line at the center, and I start walking backwards. And out of the corner of my eye, and both to you, Russell and Billy, One of you did this because I didn't ignite it. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a flame start following me. Again, total like Wile E. Coyote. So I drop the jerry can as the adrenaline kicks in, and I start scrambling on hands and feet up the berm. And as I get to the top of the berm, that's when the flame catches me. On my left arm, from the elbow down, catches on fire. So I stop, drop, and roll down the other side of the berm, which puts sand all up in this fresh wound. And I stand up, and Billy and Russell the Love Muscle, "Oh my gosh, are you okay?" And at the moment, I thought I was. I didn't feel any pain. And I'm looking at my hand and going, "Well, it's a little red, but it's not too bad." Well, then a couple seconds goes by and red becomes dark red. And then dark red becomes mahogany. And then mahogany gets, and now the pain is kicking in. And I can't put enough canteens of water on this wound. And so I'm doing, it had to have been like 80 kilometers an hour down this dirt road. Oh, so the burn pit was outside of the wire. We couldn't burn inside the wire. So I am doing 80 kilometers getting back to Solomon Islands. And at this point, they had the three different guard towers, or three checkpoints. It wasn't even guard towers, three checkpoints. First checkpoint, you had to clear your identification and clear your rifle. First one, you cleared your rifle. Second is where they checked your ID. And then the third was the LPOP with the machine gunner. And they were, you know, the last line of defense. So I pull up to the first one and I quickly clear my rifle. Everything's great. Pull up to the second checkpoint where they're checking IDs, and I'm pulling my ID out as fast as I can. I set my arm on fire. I need to go to medical. I need to go to BIS. And, you know, the guy's, whatever. "Well, yeah, but we need to see your ID. I'm like, "Dude, I set my explicit arm on fire. "Yeah, but we need to see your ID." So I'm showing him my ID, and I'm getting out of the Humvee at this point. And I hear the guy in the LPOP shout down, "He's got to clear his rifle again." And so I get up on the hood of the MV, the Humvee, and using exceedingly colorful language, "I burnt my blank arm. Let me in." And so they finally do let me in. I get over, and boy, the Navy corpsman, there's a reason why no Marine unit will allow you to punk their corpsman. Doc is your saving grace when you, as a dumb Marine, make some stupid decision and they're the ones bailing you out and giving you morphine. So I'm in BAS. There's a female doc. We'll just leave it there. Female doc. And all I remember after they gave me morphine was that I was very flirtatious. And evidently, I was so flirtatious that the Marine Corps captain that came in and tried to get the report of what happened, I guess I was being quite insubordinate. And it was this doc that kind of saved me and say, "Hey, you know, he's on morphine. Some people, especially if they're not familiar or not used to painkillers, they act really, really loopy. You know, get the report later, you know, da, 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 da." And one thing led to another, and it was a short interlude at Camp Solomon Islands. And I will just leave the story here. We were in the back of a Humvee ambulance that is nowhere near as romantic as it sounds. If you've seen the back of a Humvee ambulance, it's three cots in what? Not even what, 12 feet. So she's lying, I'm on top, there's a bar that's right at head level. And so we'll just say I repeatedly bashed my head. It was nowhere near as enjoyable as it could have been had we been elsewhere. So those are my two stories around, stupidities, whether it's fire or water with the jacuzzi. Ay, ay, ay.
Oh my gosh.
Another fun story. This is a story that I personally enjoy. Maybe some of my other guys don't enjoy it as much. During the OIF-2 to OIF-3 stayover from our unit, 1st BSSG, Brigade Service Support Group, we stayed over and we became, I think it was 2nd CLB, Combat Logistics Battalion. But really, we were 1st MARDIV guys that were just holding over to 2nd MARDIV. And they wanted really nothing to do with us. Just go out, man the flight line, make sure supply is running, we don't care. I believe I can speak for all the boys that I was deployed with. It was the best deployment because nobody messed with us. We basically were able to do whatever the heck we wanted as long as supply was taken care of and as long as that flight line was taken care of. The Marine Corps and the Army have different rules, and I'm not sure if it is still this way, but during OIF 1, 2, 3, and 4, an average deployment for the Army was 12 to 13 months, a full year deployment, and they had their R&R time. For the Marine Corps at that time, an average deployment was 6 months. And I'm not sure why, I've heard some people try to explain it, but whatever the case was, the Marine Corps was 6 to 8 months for a full deployment. The Army was 12 to 13 months. So as a holdover, they're saying to us, the holdovers, well, now you need to take R&R. You're going to be here for a year plus. You must take R&R. Anywhere the Air Force is flying, you can go ahead and puddle jump and go. And of course, you know, I've got parents back home. I've got friends back home. That's where I want to go. My mother was German. She became a citizen in 92. My dad was a U.S. soldier, met her while he was in the Army, brought a foreign wife home with him. But my mother takes Christmas very, very seriously. It's not just a commercial holiday. It really is when you idealize what Christmas is supposed to be about family and religion and forgiving and healing. You know, my mother really instilled that value on Christmas in me. And so when they were giving us our opportunities of when do you want to take R&R, I wanted to take mine at Christmas. So it meant I was going to be there the longest. Everybody else was going to go on their R&R first. I didn't care, though. I wanted to be home for Christmas. And every time we sent somebody home, they always asked the same question. So what do you want me to send you when I'm back stateside? And the question or the answer was always, booze. Send booze. And every guy would come back from these holdovers. Yes, I still blame each one of you for this. And go, dude, I sissed out. I wussed out. You know, they're saying it's illegal to send booze through the Postal Service. So I'm not going to do that. We're getting closer now, Christmas. It's October-ish. We're getting closer. And command communicates with the gunny that was over me for this unit. And gunny comes and communicates that, hey, we can't send you home for Christmas. Intel is saying that there's going to be an increase in tensions in the Sunni Triangle. It's just not going to happen. You need to pick another time. It has to be sooner. I said, well, okay, well, how about Thanksgiving? Okay, yeah, we'll make Thanksgiving work. So I fly out for Thanksgiving, get to spend Thanksgiving with my family. And I ask the same question. What do you guys want when I'm back stateside? And so I want gin. I want whiskey. I want, you know, whatever it was, tequila. I want whatever it was that the guys wanted. And so I'm writing my notes. And I get back.
So it was apparently illegal to send it in the mail, but was it legal to for them to have it?
No, it was. So in the country of Iraq, it was illegal to be consuming alcohol.
Yeah.
Hashish was legal for the military. It wasn't legal for us to smoke it, but it was. But alcohol was illegal.
So booze was illegal for the military personnel just because in Iraq.
Because of the local customs.
So
local
customs laws. It wasn't for the local customs, it could have been. You could have drank.
I can't speak for command on that, but it stands to reason that, we should have been able to consume alcohol.
At least that's the excuse they use.
So I get home, sitting at the grocery store, and I'm trying to buy all this stuff. And I realize, how in the heck am I going to send this back? And it dawns on me, Christmas is coming. I'm going to send gifts to the troops. And so I then go over to, it was a Target or a Walmart, whatever it was, and I start buying as many Nerf guns as I can. One Nerf gun for each one of the guys that's in my unit right now, and I'm taking the bottle. So I open up, we take an X-Acto knife and cut the seal, open the box, and we're sliding bottles of booze in these Nerf guns and then resealing them and trying to pack them in so they don't break and they can make the shipment. And so I fly back. Obviously, I beat the packages there. And the guy's, oh, yeah, you sure? You really sent it. I'm like, dude, I did. I promise. They're coming. And the packages start coming in. So,
how many did you send?
It was at least 9. So we had at least 9 bottles of hard liquor, plus the champagne that we got from other adventures.
Okay.
But I mean, I do recall Justin Pilkington always wanted Crown, so I sent him a bottle of Crown. For me, I was really into Amaretto at the time, so I sent myself a bottle of Amaretto. I believe that Joe Bishop had tequila, or maybe he had a different whiskey. Sergeant Elmer wanted vodka. There's a reason Native Americans call that fire water, man. That is not alcohol.
What was your rank at this time?
Corporal. Corporal. And so these packages are starting to roll in one by one, but my package isn't there yet. Lance Corporal Pilkington got his box. Corporal Bishop got his box. Sergeant Elmer got his box. All these boxes are coming in, but my box isn't coming in. I get a call from S1, or Gunny gets a call and sends me up to S1, says, yeah, the major has a question for you. And now, remember, I told a little bit earlier in the story, we're holdovers. Second Mardiv really doesn't care about us. Nobody talked to us. Nobody cared. So knowing now that the major wanted me to come up and chat with him, what happened? Oh, boy. And in my head, I'm thinking, I have. I've been caught.
Yeah.
I get into his office, which is just one of the blown out hangars at the time. And he pulls out this Nerf gun. Now, of course, I bought myself the biggest, baddest Nerf gun. It was this, you know, cycling machine gun, you know, 240 Golf style Nerf gun. But he pulls this box and it is dripping, soaking, falling apart in bits and pieces. And he looks, he says, Corporal Palmer, what does that smell like to you? Smells like booze, sir. Why are you getting boxes that are saturated in booze? I have no idea, Major. I have no idea, sir. I'll have to tell my friends that this is totally unacceptable. Blah, 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 blah. Eventually, he let me off because I don't know if I'm imagining this or if he actually said it. But either way, it was, you've already been punished. Your bottle of booze has been soaked into a box. It's leaked everywhere. You're not going to be able to consume it anyway. That's a bad enough punishment for you.
Yeah.
So now, you know, that's around Christmas time. New Year's Eve comes up, and we're going to have, for New Year's Eve, we're going to have the most epic Nerf war in Iraq that they've ever had. And so we're at the motor pool acting like idiots, doing Nerf wars. And consuming entirely, especially for guys that hadn't had any alcohol in several months, we got obliterated drunk. It wasn't even fun drunk anymore. It was obliterated drunk. One of the guys, my best friend in the Marine Corps, Joe Bishop, he was my best man for my wedding. It was the heavy equipment motor pool, but what we had done is taken three ISO containers and just built a plywood hallway that connected all three. And the first one was dispatch. The second one was kind of the rest area, the R&R area. And then the third one was tool checkout. And so in tool checkout, there we had a three-layer tool bench. And he was sniping all of us. He had gone prone on that second level. And it's dark, so he would just wait for guys to come by as he's sniping us with these Nerf guns. Never found them, but we finish our Nerf war. Now we're getting a little belligerent, one with another. Again, you were in the Marines as well. When Marines get bored, we get violent with one another, typically. And so it started as harmless wrestling. It quickly escalated to full-out fisticuffs. I have never been rocked so hard as I was rocked that night. Now, I'm 6 foot tall. I was in very good shape at the time. I was more physically imposing than several of the other Marines that were in the area. But Sergeant Elmer was this Hopi Native American and just scrappy, man. This guy was scrappy. And he and my best friend, Joe, got into it and he was putting Joe in his place.
So was this the New Year's Eve?
This is all the same night.
So you're drinking.
Yeah.
You're obliterated.
Yeah. We were obliterated.
Okay. So you're like, you're just doing crazy stuff and you're not even...
Just being idiots. And so he's, you know, he's messing with Joe. So I get the gall to go and, no one's going to mess with my best friend. I'm going to take you out. And admittedly, one, I was bigger than him. So I think that gave me a little bit of false confidence. And two, let's face it, you always think you're a whole lot braver when you're on the booze.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to fisticuffs. This little scrappy Hopi kicked the living snot out of me. I have never been rocked and knocked out so hard as when that guy took me out. So
you're just in an all-out fist fight with each other.
It escalated. It started friendly, and it escalated.
He's a sergeant, you're a corporal.
Yep.
Okay.
he ends up passing out drunk on the top of the ISO containers. Somewhere along the night, I lose my boots. And I'm walking from the motor pool back to the blown out building that's our barracks. And so I'm barefoot walking back, slice my foot open, from ball to heel. By the time I get back, I'm bleeding all over the place. So all of us the next morning, so now it's, you know, or probably next afternoon when we finally got up, we're getting up, we're rolling out of bed. Everyone was fine. There was no drama dropout. We just realized that, dagnabbit, you know, you think you're smart when you're on the booze. You realize you're just a freaking idiot. And we ended up just beating the living snot out of each other. And in that same blown out building, two things. The insurgents were walking in mortar rounds. When I was a kid and you're watching military videos or military movies, and you've got the seasoned gunnery sergeant who's walking through the field with explosions going off and gunfire. You're like,
dude, like in Platoon where it's
like... Yeah! Like, dude, that guy has brass balls. How in the hell is he doing that? And then you get over there and you realize how quickly you get desensitized to incoming.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, again, you watch this in the movies, you can hear how close incoming really is. You learn to ID that whistle, and is it a whistle that's actually going to get close to me, or is it a whistle that whatever is, you know, it's going to land a mile away? I don't care. And they're walking in from Ramadi. They're trying to walk in these mortar rounds into the munitions bay that was at Altacottam. So that, to fill in on the story, as a heavy equipment operator, that was one of our missions, was to clean out all of the Soviet era munitions that Saddam had stored there at Takatam. So, you know, again, that was what we were doing day in and day out for that particular part of the deployment. They had got a lucky rocket fire in that got into one of the munitions bays. I'm not sure which one, but it got into one of the bays and chain reaction.
Oh, boom, man.
Boom, 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 boom. We know that they got into the white phosphorus rounds because it was the most awe-inspiring 4th of July Day firework display as bay after bay after bay after bay is just, you know, cooking off.
Yeah.
You know, small arms that are cooking off. You've got rockets that are blowing up. You've got small munitions that are exploding. But so at that same blown out building, we're just sitting there on the top of the ISO container, luckily sober this time.
How far away were you?
And I honestly can't recall. It was close enough that you felt the shock waves hit.
But you could
sit
there and watch it.
Yeah, but yeah, we didn't feel like shrapnel. There was a risk of shrapnel. I don't recall any shrapnel ever getting anybody. But the second part of that story, same area. They're walking in, or we're in the same blown out Altacottam Air Force hangar.
This is where you sleep.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. We converted the hangar into a barracks. We just put up plywood walls and we'd set up our racks. And I am in, or heavy equipment is, you walk in through the big double doors and we are the first little cubicle, plywood cubicle on the right. My rack mate at the time was Joe Bishop. He was on the bottom. I was on the top. And I believe, if I remember correctly, no, he was on graveyard with me. So we were both on graveyard shift at this time. So it's in the middle of the day and we're both sleeping. And again, you can sleep through incoming. I still sleep through loud noises. It doesn't bother me anymore. Our command required us to have our rifles, the sling wrapped around our leg. Mm-hmm. So again, nobody could steal your rifle. It was wrapped around your leg. And we didn't sleep in Kevlars, but we did sleep in our flak jackets. Someone grabs me off the top bunk from my flak jacket and flings me off this rack. Get your uniform on, get your Kevlar on, incoming, incoming, incoming. And I'm totally dazed, out of it, have no idea. I am stumbling out, my rifle is on the ground, you know, tied to my ankle as it's bopping around. It was the most unprofessional sight you've probably ever seen. I felt like Mr. Bean in a Marine Corps uniform. But I'm tumbling out, reaching for my Kevlar. And we do get out the back end of the bay and we find out that not 5 meters from where I was sleeping, one of those mortars had landed and gone dud. So well within the blast range. Yeah. I tell people, I should not be here. You know, if you, there's that old quote, you'll never find an atheist in a foxhole.
Yeah.
You know, there was, even if you divine, or were skeptical about divine providence, skeptical about theology, man, when you realize that you were absolutely within the death range of a mortar and that mortar went
dud. Did it just land right outside your...
Right outside. heavy equipment was the very first on the right. All of us were right within that death. If that would have gone off, I would have gone to sleep and I'd have never woke up.
How big were those mortars they were firing?
I believe that was a 30 mic, Mike. 30 millimeter.
30?
No.
That's pretty small.
See, this is why I was talking to my guys.
60, and trying to get my 82s or like 120s.
I don't recall.
You don't know.
Now I'm going to have to go back and see. When I was preparing for this and I was chatting with some of the guys, I really realized that, dagnabbit, I wish I'd have kept a journal. So actually, for anybody listening to this podcast, kid you not, guys, you're going to, you know, whether you're a first responder, whether you're military, you know, or whatever it is you're doing in your life, and it's, you know, high stress, lots of adventure, whatever. You think in the moment that you will never forget what's going on. You're never going to forget this. How in the world can you forget? How in the world can I forget the size of a munition that darn near killed me? And that only by it going dud did my life, you know, be preserved. Why would I forget small details like that? And you do. You get on with your life. Certain memories pop out of your brain. New memories go in. So I invite you, the listener, start journaling. Even if it's just a couple of sentences. Hey, this happened at work today. This is how I felt about it. Whatever. Just start journaling. The future you is going to thank you for it. Your children possibly will thank you for it because they're going to get to see my children only get, and true, I only tell them certain stories about my deployments.
You don't tell them about the ambulance?
No, story? We don't talk about Doc. Nope. That story we're going to keep under wraps. And as they get older, I may be willing to share other stories, but just for your own edification, if not for your children, and if not for your grandchildren, and your great-great-grandchildren, do it for yourself, because I realize out of these life-changing days, each one of those deployments changed me as a man, as a person, and I'm realizing now as I try to go back and think of the details that a lot of it has slipped from my memory. And so I chatted with some of my boys that I'd want to do something, not a podcast like what you're doing, but just the next time we meet up, we try to meet up every couple of years somewhere.
Yeah.
I said, dude, I just want to bring a microphone out. And just as we're sitting around, you know, drinking a beer and we're telling our stories to one another, I want that recorded for each one of us. So sure. That as we continue to get older, we can reminisce.
Yeah, I recently started going through my officer letters. I had probably have like 8 full-size journals full just from 4 years of my officer years. I just barely started tapping into my letters that I wrote my wife in OCS, and I come across 3 stories that I laughed all day about that I was like, I didn't remember that. But then once you read it, it's like, oh my gosh, I remember that. And then you're just laughing all day about it. It's great. So I agree. I've been using Isagenics since 2017. These products have made a world of difference in my quality of life, health, energy, muscle definition, strength, and endurance. My bread and butter products have been the Daily Essentials Multivitamins with Isagenesis, which is a telomere support supplement, the Isolene Meal Replacement Shake, the Tri-Release Protein Shake, the Collagen Green Drink, and the Cleanse for Life Support System. However, Isagenics has many products and can cater to your unique lifestyle and goals. Click the link in the show notes or visit nmp.isagenics.com. Besides just using the products, there is an option to partner with me and the company to build your own business with no capital upfront. You can do as little as pay for your products and as much as making a full-time income. I love these products and will use them the rest of my life. For more information, you can email me at ghostturdstories@gmail.com.
In the military years, I had a physical abnormality that actually at ASVAB, they tried to not allow me to enlist. We won't get off into the details on that. Totally fine. Nothing that should preclude someone from being in the military. But this physical abnormality was noticeable when I wore firm-fitting clothing, like silkies. And so the guys in my unit, you know, they would make fun of that physical abnormality. One of the stories that both Boyland and Trejo had brought back up, I'm like, dude, I totally forgot about that. We would play midnight Chemlite Kevlar football. And again, just stupid, you know, in Alticottum, in the motor pool, we'd stick Chemlites in the Molly D-rings of our flak jackets, put on our Kevlar, and just beat the living snot out of one another. And all in good fun.
Combat. we call it combat soccer.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, I forgot about combat soccer till now. Oh my gosh.
See, and one time. Yeah. One, I made the mistake of wearing my silkies to one of those. And when I got rocked, there were certain abnormalities that fell out and became plainly visible for everybody in the unit. And so that, for Boyland specifically, that he's, oh, I laughed so hard. I've never laughed so hard in my entire life. Screw you. Shut up. You suck.
Oh my gosh. So do you have any stories about boot camp that come up?
Two stories come to mind. One, my best friend in boot camp was Recruit Miller. And dagnabbit, man, most times, or at least the guys I talk to, they say, hey, do you keep up with the guys that you went to boot camp with? To my knowledge, I have never seen a single Marine that was in Platoon 92, and I don't even remember what, you know, battalion that was at the time, but I don't recall ever meeting or talking to any of those Marines that I went to boot camp with ever again.
Yeah.
But while I was in, my best friend at the time was Recruit Miller. Recruit Miller was a wonderful guy, but he was that Marine in the unit that caused all the drama for everybody else, because he wasn't fast enough, his rack wasn't tight enough, you know, he didn't, you know, pick up the right portion of food at the chow hall, whatever it was. And when I was his squad leader, I was getting my ass smoked because of frickin' Miller. And out of our three, I had four drill instructors. We had senior drill instructor, first hat, Staff Sergeant Phelps. Senior hat was Gunnery Sergeant Salinas, which was easy to remember because I grew up in Salinas. Staff Sergeant Merced was our second hat, our knowledge hat. And then our third hat, I don't remember his name, and we'll get to a story about him. He was the bulldog. He was the guy that, you know, brought nothing but chaos into the recruit bay. Miller was supposed to have his LBV, you know, mounted a certain way. You know, you remember that in boot camp, everything had to be exactly however the you know, drill instructor said it was supposed to be laid out. His LBV was not laid out in the proper way. I was his squad leader.
LBV was the
load-bearing vest.
Load-bearing vest, that's right.
And I watch as Staff Sergeant Phelps, who was, by the way, my favorite of the different drill instructors. I really respected that man. But I watched him like a gazelle leap by strides from one end of the bay to the other, and I'm thinking, oh crap, I'm gonna get smoked because of Miller. I don't know what came over me. I don't know if it was defensive, if it was paternal, if it was stupid. It was probably stupid. But I locked my arm out and clotheslined to protect Miller from first hat. Now, I would like to say that it was this epic moment where Staff Sergeant Phelps, you know, got clotheslined and landed on his back and looked up with respect in his eyes, knowing that I was becoming a Marine and that I was defending men in my unit. I would like to say that. That's not what happened. What happened, well, I got decked right in the gut and I keeled over. You know,
did he land on his back?
No, and that was the thing. Okay. I wish I could say that I had the force that happened. It hit. He stumbled a little bit. You know, he backpedaled a little bit. But one, you know, good authoritative step forward. Bam! Right in
so
my
he knew what he was doing, because he couldn't hit you in the face, because then otherwise hit you in the gut, then there's no evidence,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Solar plexus shot. I keeled over to that. Elmer, later, you know, the story I told earlier that was alcohol-induced, that was the hardest I've taken to date. But boot camp, that was the hardest I had ever been punched up to that point in my life. keeled me over, and I still got smoked. Miller got smoked.
What was Miller doing that he was after him again?
He didn't have his LBV.
Oh, that's right. Okay, sorry.
So we were all trying to get down into formation to go to chow hall, and he was still fiddle with the stuff. And so I got laid out. We both got smoked, and I lost my squad leadership. So there went PVC or PFC. You know, the idea was if you get to graduation and you're a squad leader, if you went in as a private, you know, get an automatic promotion. So there went my promotion. So thanks, Miller. Thanks for doing that to me, dude. Thanks. If I ever see you again. And then the second one was my bulldog. Second story that I remember. Did you ever do deck towel 500?
Was that bear crawl, but you're pushing the towel?
Yep.
So we never did that, but well, my senior drill instructor made someone do it after lights went out for like an hour, and he was...
It smokes.
It's horrible. Yeah. It's horrible stuff.
Yeah, for those of you who've never had the joy, the distinct pleasure of deck towel 500, imagine taking, you know, a towel that is just a little bit larger than an average hand towel that you'd have in your kitchen, about twice that size, but that's your towel. And having soapy, suddy water thrown onto a linoleum or a tile floor, and then getting into a bear crawl. So you're on your hands and knees, hands and feet, and you've got the deck towel under your two hands in front of you, and you are bear crawling, bear running, using this soapy, suddy towel to give you some level of less resistance so you can run around. And you're running around the interior portion of this recruit bay. And for us, our entire platoon would do it. And the way you were done being smoked was if you were first. As we went around, if you were the first one there, then you got to get up and be done. And then whoever was not first, and you know that rest of the platoon kept going and kept
going. So every lap, someone was first.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Every lap, one guy would come out. And we had 92 guys. So we're doing, you know,
and it was a race.
Yeah.
So you're like fighting each other, basically.
Correct, yeah. Okay. You're kicking each other. You're knocking each other over. I mean, I'm sure that the drill instructors would go back into their office and just laugh their asses off. Watching these 18-year-old nitwits knocking each other over.
They had a window, right? So they could see.
Correct.
Yeah, they could watch it.
To this very day, just even talking about him now, I can feel the anger in my belly. He did his job right. As a bulldog, your job is to make sure you make the life of the recruits a living hell. He made my life a living hell, and I've sworn, and I still swear to this day, that if I ever see that man in a dark alley, I will take the assault charge. I am punching that guy in the chin. But what one of the things that he did, or the worst thing in my brain that he did, or what left a lasting memory on me, was on one of these deck towels, I had won. Nope. Get back in there, Palmer. And then, you know, I lost a couple, whatever. And then I'd won a second time. Nope. Get back in there. And then I would go another few times. And I think I had three victories. So three times I should have been pulled off. He wouldn't let me. So I said, screw this. I'm going to outthink this frickin' drill instructor. He can't have me continue to do this if I'm bleeding. I'm looking at the tile wall that is partitioning the main bay from where the head, where the latrines are, the head and the shower unit. And so I deck towel 500 as fast as I can, flat side of my head down, bam, knock myself as full speed right at the top of my head, right into this tile wall, lay myself out. I'm starting to bleed, but he comes up to me and he grabs me by the collar. What did you do? I'm done deck toweling, sir. And I got out of it. So that was the solution.
Share with us one or two of your most difficult stories. And if you have any experience with post-traumatic stress or mental health challenges, tell us how you managed those, overcame them, et cetera.
One of the hard things, or one of the things that lasted, was actually that mortar round coming in. On one hand, absolute blessing. I'm still alive. I'm still here. But I think this is one thing that a lot of first responders and military veterans, combat military veterans, can sympathize with. When you get a firm and visceral grasp of your own mortality, I believe that changes you on a fundamental level. Now, whether it changes you for a positive or a negative is how you react to the change.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe in my heart of hearts and in my bone marrow, when you finally get to face your own mortality face to face, there's nowhere else to hide, that changes you on a fundamental level. This was something my dad said, and I'm sorry, Dad, I'm going to slaughter this direct quote, but when I left for my first deployment, he pulled me aside and he said, you know, you grow up, you watch Rambo, you watch these different movies, and you always see that the atrocity happens to the other guy. It never happens to the hero in the movie, the hero in the book. The atrocity always happens to the other guy. And my dad says, when you're over there, to the guy next to you, you are the other guy. And even, you know, again, stupid 18-year-old. At 18, I thought I had everything figured out. And the older you get, the more you realize you were really stupid at 18. But it was having this serious moment where I know my dad was trying to communicate the absolute reality, which was in the back of my brain. You play war as a kid, you play army as a kid, you play soldier as a kid, and you know, oh, I got shot by the Nerf gun, oh, I'm dead. But it's not real, because you just respawn. You know, you pick up your Nerf gun and you get back to it. And my father was trying to instill, you do your duty. It is your responsibility to take care of the Marine to your left, to your right, to take care of the soldier to the left or right, to take care of the airman, the sailor, to take care of your paramedic, whatever it is. You take care of the guy and the gal to the left and to the right of you, but never forget that you are the other guy. The scariest moment that I had out of all of my four deployments was back again at Solomon Islands. This is back when I'm PFC, stupid as the day is long. We're coming through the berm. There was still a large concern about dirty scuds. We knew that Saddam had used chemical weapons against the Kurds. And I don't know how many safety stand downs we went through about getting into MOP level 5. We would run, but when we were back in CONUS getting ready to deploy, we were doing, you know, boots and utes, MOP level 5 runs in Southern California in the middle of summer. It sucked. You were sweating balls. And with the gas mask, it's laborious breathing. But they wanted, you know, we knew, quote unquote, we knew that Saddam was going to use dirty bombs against us. So we're over in Solomon Islands, and the alarm comes over for incoming, and you could see the exhaust, you know, coming over. So we know we've got incoming, and so all of us, you know, we're reaching down, getting into MOP level, and my unit, the unit that I was with at the time, we were all well-versed. We had done it 100,000, we'd done it 100 times. We hadn't done it 100,000 times. But we had gotten into MOP level 5 training repeatedly. And the reason the military has you do the same darn thing over and over again is so that it's muscle memory. Mm-hmm. So we were getting in to MOP level 5. We're going into our little pissant bunkers, man. Wouldn't protect you even from a personnel grenade. But you know, it was the illusion of protection. Mm-hmm. But as I am donning and clearing my gas mask, the little hose that is connected on the inside so that you can actually hook up to your canteen and drink. I knocked it off with my chin. I get down into the little pissant plywood bunker and we're sitting there. And it's just the waiting is what kills you. When rounds are actually coming down range in a convoy, when the incoming is actually going on around you, there's something going on. Your brain has something to concentrate on. Yeah. But just sitting there and waiting for the inevitable, for me, that was the hardest. That was the mental challenge. And we're just waiting and waiting. You'd hear off in the distance, boom! And then silence. And you're waiting. And you're waiting. And I'm sure that when I die and I get to go back and relive my life or watch it as a movie, that I'm going to go back to this moment and I'm going to realize that I was only sitting in that bunker for an hour or less. But in my brain at the moment, I was there for hours, man. And it was playing with me. And you're in MOP level 5, middle of summer in Iraq. And I was sweating my balls off. And all I can think of is, I'm going to die. That was I'm not going to die a hero. I'm not going to die in combat. I'm not going to die from incoming. I'm not going to die from small arms fire. I'm going to die of dehydration because I'm a jackass and knocked the hose off. Every minute, you know, to me is now feeling like 10 minutes and it's just drawing on and on and on. And I note that nobody else is talking. Everyone's just sitting there looking at each other in stunned silence, waiting to hear what we need to do next. However long it was, whether it was an hour or whether it was like I felt 3 to 4 hours, I started to note that I was getting exceedingly dizzy and I wasn't able to concentrate. Now, it could be that part of that was just adrenaline and boredom, but in my brain at the moment, I was dying of dehydration. I was sweating. I was, you know, in my brain, you couldn't convince me at that moment otherwise. I was dying. And so I'm having this internal battle with myself of, do I break my seal? Now, if there's a chemical or biological agent in the area and you break the seal, well, what we were taught, you're good as dead. You broke the seal, you're going to be dead. And so I make this judgment call at the moment that I'm going to break my seal with just two fingers. It's going to be my thumb on my left hand and my index finger. I'm going to reach up in there because at this point I had figured out that my hose was down there. And I'm going to connect it, dawn and clear all over again. The most frightened I have ever been in my life was the preceding 3 to 5 minutes after that. You know, when you're so cognizant, so aware, you think you're making stuff up in your own head. Does that really hurt? Is my muscle really twitching? Oh, what's really going on? Every little thing that was going on with me, I felt like I was going to die. You know, again, nothing happened. We found out later there were no dirty scuds. But that moment in it of itself, even though there was all the danger was imagined. Yes, there was incoming, but nothing that got close to Solomon Islands. There was no impact around Solomon Islands. It was all in my head. But the visceral fear I felt changed me. And I do believe in most ways for the better. People, you met me outside of military. We were in a business networking organization. And people say that I'm flamboyant and that I'm neurotic, that I'm energetic, that I'm kooky, that I have these high vibrations, etc. And I don't disagree with them, and I don't feel embarrassed about that.
Yeah.
Because the only things I was concerned about when I really thought, whether it was incoming during convoys, because you know, I took small arms contact during Phantom Fury, etc. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, we were at Ramadi. Ramadi, if you're familiar with Jocko and his book, yep. Ramadi was where everything was going down. I was at Ramadi at the same time, actually, after reading his book, I was there at the same time Jocko was. Mm-hmm. And so in my head, I like to believe that I was standing next to him in the chow hall at Ramadi and, you know, whatever. But it steeled me and it gave me the confidence to not care about the little embarrassments in life, because I was not, when I thought I was gonna die and I knew this dirty bomb was gonna kill me, I was not thinking about the little embarrassments that I had suffered in my life up to that point. The only things that were bothering me was, who did I not express my affection to? Who did I not tell that I loved that I should have told? What had I not done because I felt fear? What did I neglect in my life? What adventures did I not go on because I had to be cool? You can't do that because, you know, that adventure's not cool. You can't hang out with that person, even though he's, you know, he's totally cool. You can't hang out with him because he's not a cool guy to hang out with. Those were the thoughts that went through my head. So in that way, there was a blessing in fearing for my life, because it showed me truly, at a young age, again, 18, 19, 20, at a young age, how inconsequential those things really are.
Yeah, so just to reference your energy, because I get to see your fun energy on a regular basis in those networking groups, and it's just, you know what, I've got one life to live, and this is who I am, and I'm going to be proud of who I am, and I feel the same way. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. And I'm outside the box, too, you know, as you know, so.
Yep.
That's great. So, did you ever struggle with any sort of mental health challenges, or?
Yes. Now, what I want to say is there were boys in my unit who absolutely had it harder than I did. I think there's a lot of variables that go into trauma.
Sure.
One, what are you specifically exposed to? And that's what a lot of people concentrate on. Were you exposed to combat? Were you exposed to dead bodies? But there's also the aspect of what tool sets did you have before going to that situation? And I praise my father for instilling a Stoic-esque personality before I got there, which I think helped fortify me in a way to better defend against mental traumas. And then, honestly, this is the last defense. I disassociate. And I do this with like toxic relationships. There are members of my family, not my immediate family, but my extended family, that I realized after a while that those relationships weren't serving me. And so I physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually remove myself from those situations. And some people say, "You're being a dick." I was like, "No, I'm defending myself. This is how I'm going to defend myself." And so when I experienced mental and emotional traumas, I believe, and I can't really psychoanalyze myself, but I believe that I disassociate from some of the things that I experienced as well. And that gave me some
level of protection. So you think that's a protection mechanism disassociate. So do you think you're dealing with them or just disassociating?
I feel like I'm disassociating, but I'm going to get into sure. You and I very briefly spoke about a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And this will tie in. Two distinct situations happened, and there was a lot of small situations. There was a night I really drank too much and had different things I was thinking about and did not conduct myself in a professional manner. And I still regret the young lady that I was with at the moment acting in such a way. It was unbecoming. Nothing happened to her. There was no violence, but I did not handle PTSD very well that evening. And I still, if you're listening, I still apologize for that. But there were two other moments. One was after my very first deployment, after OIF-1. And I was in Salinas. I was at Northridge Mall. And I'm walking through, and this is not meant to offend anybody. It's just the way it is. It's the way it went. Hispanics share complexion similarities to Iraqis, to Middle Eastern men. The dark hair, the dark complexion, the size, the bone structure even. There's a lot of similarities. Not exact, but there's a lot of similarities. I had got back. This was after, I believe, OAF-1 in total, after all the times that I stayed. That was only 9 months. But I got back and I'm walking through the mall and I see three Hispanic men totally minding their own business. I don't even think they looked at me. But they were walking towards me and I immediately had the gut reaction to reach for my rifle. And this is all happening in like a split second. One, my rifle is supposed to be spine carried. You know, at that time it was M16. When you had it slung over your back, muzzled to the ground, it was a spine carry. I reached back. It wasn't there with my right hand. With my left hand, I reached to make sure I was wearing my flak jacket and I had nothing. And there was a visceral anger and self-defense fear. And again, all in a split second, because then I realized I'm at Northridge Mall. I'm in Salinas. These are not enemy combatants. They're not even Middle Eastern men. These are just three guys hanging out on a Saturday at the mall. They mean you no harm. But there were moments, and that was the most visceral moments that it dawned on me that, there were certain skills or mindsets or tactics or whatever you want to call them that you adopt for self-preservation. And I had to not unlearn. I don't want to say I unlearned, but you learn when it is appropriate to act with aggression and when it is not appropriate. And then the second, and this is the persistent issue that I deal with, 4th of July. I love this country. I don't trust this government too much, but that's another story. I love my country. If things hit the fan again, and they would take me, I'm a little bit heavier than I was in my young 20s. A little bit rounder and softer in the midsection. But if they would take me back, man, and this was like a World War II style confrontation, I firmly believe, and to my wife, I apologize, but I firmly believe I would be back in that recruiting office. I love
that.
No,
we'd have to go together, I guess. So.
There you go. But I don't enjoy 4th of July. I don't enjoy the fireworks. That still bothers me. Mm. Not in an incapacitating way. I've been to fireworks displays, but I don't enjoy them. I get the adrenaline dump. My heartbeat races. I really don't sleep well that night. I don't have flashbacks per se. I just have a physiological response that persists for a day or two or three. So my wife, bless her heart, several years ago when we got married, she says, hey, we'll get a permit and do some backpacking. So not just a day hike, but we're going to camp out somewhere.
Okay.
And that became a tradition for us on 4th of July. We're gone for either like an overnight, a one day in, one day out, or a 3 day, one day in, stay
around. So you do that every year.
And we don't miss, like last year, there were some things that happened that it wasn't available. But, my wife, she didn't know me while I was in the military, nor immediately afterwards. It was almost a decade later that she met me. And in her family, she doesn't have a lot of military exposure. So there's a different mentality, a different lifestyle. And sure. It just took a little bit of gelling. But bless her heart, she does the very best that she can do. And she is so patient and considerate. When I do have episodes, I don't feel like I need to go and apologize. And I know I've talked to combat vets who've said that that's one thing that unfortunately causes a little turmoil in marriages when they feel like they have to apologize. And if you do something jacked up, yes, apologize for that. But a physiological response to trauma, there is nothing you need to apologize for there. That is part of you, and there's nothing you need to apologize. But on the functionality side, and this is my invitation, whether you're a first responder, combat veteran, police force, or you've had other things happening in your life that have caused some level of trauma, and you're looking for ways to address that. Troy knows this. I'm not a classically trained therapist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I have no certificates, no training. Take my opinion for the exact 2 cents after inflation that it's worth. But for me, reading the Stoics really gave me functional tool sets to help me when I felt and when I feel episodes. And the two specifically that I recommend are Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius. Now, Marcus Aurelius is a little bit more well-known. More people know or at least know the name Marcus Aurelius because he was a Roman emperor. More people know his name and his works. It's not the diary of Marcus Aurelius. It basically is a diary. It's his private thoughts that he has written down about what it is to be a moral man. The overarching theme of the Stoics is control the things you can control and don't get tied up in the things you can't control. I cannot control an instant physiological response. When a car backfires and I immediately go back, when a firework goes off and I immediately go back, that is a physiological response that I have no control over. What I do have control over is the very next 10 seconds. How do I respond? How do I act? How do I react that very next 10 seconds after an episode occurs? So Marcus Aurelius, if you haven't read any Stoics, Marcus Aurelius is far more approachable, in my opinion, because he's not writing to convince anyone. This is his own private thoughts that he's writing in his own journal that now has become published. So some people say that it's a little harder to read because it's very disjointed. It'd be like somebody reading your journal. But Marcus Aurelius was very poetic. And if you've ever read like The Art of War by Sun Tzu, same kind of thing. Sun Tzu, when he wrote The Art of War, it's like different little quotes that they don't really tie into one another, but you can read it page to page to page. That's kind of like what Marcus Aurelius's read is.
Yeah.
And then there's Epictetus. Epictetus, his work is he, as a philosopher, trying to teach the Stoic mentality to a student. So it's a little bit more technical, a little bit more nuts and boltsy So some people say it's a harder read, but in my opinion, and for me personally, I have gleaned functional tools that has helped me cope with, deal with in a healthy way, a non-disassociative way. Again, this is, you know, a 10,000 foot view looking down. The Stoics do not purport or invite you to disassociate. That's not a healthy coping mechanism. That's going to more than likely rear its head in ugly ways.
If you're not facing it, eventually it's going to backfire.
Correct.
Sure.
What the Stoics, and again, getting to Epictetus specifically, you look at the things that you can control and you adopt the different tool sets about the mental clarity of dealing with what is directly in front of you. Another Stoic was Seneca. I'm not superbly familiar. I've only read parts of Seneca's works, but I'm going to, for those of you who've read Seneca, I'm going to slaughter this paraphrase, but it's concern yourself only with what is in front of you, not with what you fear is going to be in the future for you. Yeah. A lot of the anxiety that we deal with
I learned a recent term. It's called future tripping. It's like it's a drug. You're just tripping on the future all the time.
Yeah. And that's basically what Seneca is getting at. Yeah. That so much of the heartache that we endure is heartache that we don't even need to. We're worrying about things that aren't even real.
Yeah.
I was worried about a dirty bomb. And it was a life-changing event because I was going to die. I made a life and death choice to break my seal. And that affected me, but it was all fugazi. It didn't exist.
Yeah.
So that's my invitation. If you want to audible it, you can get it free on YouTube. Like Marcus Aurelius, I think you can go through Marcus Aurelius on YouTube in 2 hours, less time than a long format movie. And for those out there who feel that they're struggling, there's some gems in there that have really helped me cope in a healthy way with PTSD events.
Yeah, I love it, Eric. So I got two quick questions before we end here. Your arm doesn't have any evidence of burn on it. And what'd you do with the hot tub?
You're correct. It never got to third degree. So third degree burns is where it does permanent nerve subdermal damage. And that's typically when you see, even when skin grafts are done and your skin grows back, and it's subdermal. So it's permanent damage. Mine was a severe second degree.
Okay.
So they say second degree is the most painful.
Because you still feel it.
Yeah.
You're still feeling it.
You feel it. But when you got on 10 cc's of morphine, you don't really feel a whole lot anymore. So yeah, total blessing. And I give, tip my hat 10,000 times over to those in the medical field, especially those in the military medical field. You know, again, you talk to any Marine who's been out in the field, and we all love Doc.
What'd you do with the hot tub?
Oh, the hot tub was left behind. So when First MARDIV came back, so it was for Iraq, they were going back and forth between 1st MARDIV and 2nd MARDIV. That's 1st Marine Corps Division in Camp Pendleton and 2nd Marine Corps Division out of Lejeune. The deployments were swapping back and forth. You would leave most of the stuff that you acquired. You'd try to sell it, but the incoming unit knew that you weren't taking it with
you. Did you tell your incoming replacements, hey, here's a hot tub, by the way?
Yeah. And from what I was told, and again, I don't know if this is empirically true, what I was told is that the unit that replaced us didn't think it was a good idea to have a hot tub, so they disassembled it right after we were gone. You have no idea what you've done, what kind of work went into that, what kind of lies to, you know, some innocent first sergeant in the Army. There was, I guess that was the other thing. We almost came fisticuffs fight when we stole the hydraulic hoses from Motor T. So there was conflict there. There was lies. There was cover-ups. There was, incognito hiding things in ISO's containers. There was planning, dagnabbit, and they just disassembled it.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thanks so much for coming. I really appreciate it. It means a lot, and look forward to your continued friendship.
Yeah, I appreciate the time.
Thank you for listening. Please tell your friends and family so that we can bring more joy and awareness to those struggling with suicide ideation and the families who desperately need help after the loss of someone they love to suicide.